Patricia Camilleri, and in this series called Talking Books, I shall be asking my guests about their personal relationship with the written word. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today for Talking Books, Professor Ivan Kallous. Professor Kallous was awarded his PhD by Cardiff University's Centre for Critical and Cultural Theory in 1998. He's Associate Professor and Head of the Department of English at the University of Malta, where he teaches courses in contemporary narrative and literary and cultural theory. He's also the coordinator of the taught MA in Modern and Contemporary Literature and Criticism and co-convener of the Faculty of Arts Literature and Comparison Research Seminar Series. Professor Kallous is the author of papers and book chapters on post-structuralism and deconstruction, on contemporary fiction and on post-humanism. His current research involves projects on post-humanism, on the fiction of Annie Proulx, and on the anagram notebooks of Ferdinand de Saussure. He has also recently co-edited a book of essays on the work of Jorge Luis Borges, published by Bucknell University Press. Welcome to you, Professor Kallous.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Well, certainly, you were definitely a person that I should interview on this program, Talking Books. And in fact, here in front of us, we have a nice display of some of the books which you intend to talk about. Let's cast our mind back to when you were a little boy or a teenager, perhaps, and tell us about some of those first books that actually talked to you.
Yeah. My word, that's that takes me back. It's very interesting, isn't it, that most people who have an intimate relationship with books look back on their childhood years and their first encounters with the printed word, and most of them say that books were a means of magicking them away, almost whisking them to a different world, to a possible world, to a fantasy world where they could almost live an alternative existence. And I suppose in those situations, when you're a little boy, you half expect someone like William Brown or the Famous Five or Billy Bunter or Harry Potter, possibly. You know, you look across in the classroom and half expect them to be there. And it's one of the wonderful things that books make possible. I think we're happy to retreat to that world, and possibly a lot of that stays with you even in adult life. I think it's all really in the end about fictionality and the need we all have to escape to a different world occasionally. My early reading, I suppose, went through a repertoire of what was considered to be canonical children's literature then. I was lucky to have parents who encouraged reading very actively, and teachers who were very good with making the class library and indeed the school library a very dynamic place. And we read Blyton, of course, everyone did that at the time. And I remember also then moving on to the Ransom stories and Biggles, of course, and later on perhaps to the books of writers like John Buchan. But I do remember, this wonderful series, the Classics Illustrated series, which these days we would call graphic novels. In those days we called them more straightforwardly comics. They were illustrated abridgments of some of the canonical works of literature. And this is where you first experienced figures like D'Artagnan from The Three Musketeers, or Robinson Crusoe, or Ivanhoe, or characters like this, and it was all quite exciting and left a lasting interest, as it were, in the characters of literature and indeed books in general.
Yes, I can distinctly remember sort of Swallows and Amazon.
Yes, yes, yes.
And other books of that genre, the idea of the summer holidays.
The summer holiday in which everything seemed possible.
Yes, exactly. That freedom that, of course, yeah, one was always sort of yearning for. in a very sort of safe but interesting and curious environment.
There's a safety in all that, and it's great, of course, when you're reading about it vicariously, as it were, through what fictional characters are experiencing.
As a teenager, then, as you were growing up, then did you feel that books was always going to be a part of your life?
I always knew that I wanted to make reading somehow part of my professional life in some way. And it just seemed the logical thing to do, to continue studying English, because it seemed to offer an avenue towards that. And gradually, I think you learn to develop an appreciation of great writing. Someone once described literature as being essentially nothing else but fine writing. And I think there is a wonderful simplicity to that. And It seemed to me, you know, you sometimes stumble upon career choices, but sometimes you can be quite deliberate about things as well. And I just thought that I felt that other people's writings spoke sufficiently to me, to the extent of wanting to perhaps devote a lot of time to their study.
Talking of great writers, of course, you know, you must have studied the sort of the Dante, the Cervantes, obviously the Shakespeare's school and afterwards. But in fact, what you really chose to specialize in at the end of the day was 20th century literature.
Yes, yes. I was always excited by the possibility of reading the great writers of one's time. It seemed to me to be a wonderful privilege to be able to study great writing as it's produced in one's lifetime, or as close to one's lifetime as possible. And of course, traditionally, the study of literature has not been like this. Traditionally, the study of literature positioned the canon in such a way that students of literature, if they were perhaps in the 60s or the 70s, perhaps took their study up to the moderns. And the rise of a contemporary canon and the emergence within universities of the study of more contemporary writing, post-1960 literature, shall we say, was always something that interested me. Having said that, the writer from the 20th century whom I find myself returning to more and more is probably Borges, Jorge Luis Borges. I think there's a wonderful quality in his work that is timeless. What he writes are essentially thought experiments turned into fables. What would it mean? I mean, one of his stories, for example, The Library of Babel, is about he imagines a library which is infinite, which contains all the books that were ever written and could ever be written, and what it would mean to be lost in a space like that, and what the architecture of a place like that would be. So it's all about impossibilities rendered very immediate in a prose that is wonderfully enigmatic, wonderfully elusive, and yet tremendously readable. I think he has, of course, been extremely influential on a number of writers, and he cheerfully admitted in his time to have been influenced by practically the entire canon of English literature, but also Edgar Allan Poe was an incredible influence on his work. And I think both writers share this quality of making the reader think that there might be hidden secrets, hidden clues, hidden allusions in their work, which they can't quite grasp, and yet are always so incredibly tantalizing. The work of interpretation with Borges never stops. And yet what makes him wonderful, I think, is that he repays critical interpretation which revisits him again and again, but he's also a page-turner, and that's an incredible combination to be able to have pulled off.
Mm. Mm. The idea of studying 20th century writers, I suppose, it was difficult for universities to take on, because they had to make a value judgment.
Yes.
About things that had not, in a inverted commas, stood the test of time.
Yes, precisely.
And that's a very difficult hurdle to overcome, really.
It's an incredibly difficult hurdle, because it places the onus on someone to say, this we think will last, this is the literature of our time, and basically we think you should not only read it but study it. And there's a tremendous responsibility which comes with that. And also the awareness that these kinds of judgments are unfortunately not always determined by the most desirable considerations, matters like marketing and, you know, publishers, promotions of certain books come into things as well. But I think there's, if one looks back at the different canons of literature, I think one realizes that many, many, many writers were recognized as great in their lifetime. Others are, of course, always recognized as great with hindsight. But it is also true to say that the readerships of writers like Dickens or Thackeray or Eliot knew that they were encountering something significant as they were reading these novelists. And I think in our time it's probably not too controversial to say that writers like Graham Swift, Ian McEwan, Julian Barnes, Angela Carter will be remembered as the writers who perhaps shaped literary fiction in the period after the 70s and 80s.
And perhaps also the idea of a sort of a postmodern environment also gave a bit of space and relaxed people enough to say, well, let's look at this.
Yes.
Let's study it. Let's try and evaluate it ourselves rather than wait for time to tell.
Yes.
And people then were given the courage and the space to be able to say, yes, this is a fantastic writer, or perhaps at the end of the day, perhaps not.
Yes. It's very interesting you should say that, because to some outlooks, the idea of a postmodern curriculum is almost a contradiction in terms. I think it was Gilbert Adair who said that these days everything comes to us inflected with the plural. In other words, people speak about postmodernisms, canons, curricula, postcolonialisms, poststructuralisms, and so on. And it's not too surprising that the field which looks at the study of contemporary writing is, of course, a very contested one, because people are positioning, people are saying, people are, as it were, laying claims for the writers they like or the writers they value, and in some instances perhaps putting one author on a curriculum rather than another. So, for instance, why would academics are faced with, of course, limited time, and when deciding how to construct a course around contemporary narrative, you just have to say that you're going to perhaps give greater representation to someone like Cormac McCarthy rather than anyone else one could mention. And those decisions are not taken lightly, of course. They're taken on the basis of developing critical consensus, as it were. One learns how to respond to that and to respect it, hopefully without being too biased oneself.
Your work really involves helping others. I mean, you're a lecturer and a professor at university, so you're helping other people understand why books remain sort of eloquent, why they are rewarding companions, and why this contemporary literature, which we're discussing, literary fiction, matters. What about the challenges of doing that in the lecture room today?
Well, in the lecture room, of course, I'm fortunate to have students who are, as it were, in the most part, converted already. They don't need any conversion, indeed, to the attractions of literature. So there is not much difficulty there, I should say. There's a tendency among students who study English at university to want to know about the writers of their time, to want to know what the emerging trends are, and to learn more about how great writing today is looked upon and assessed, and how the writers of our time are perhaps reflecting the writers of previous times, because one of the really, really striking aspects of contemporary literature is how open it is about its intertextual indebtedness to the texts of the past. I think the challenge might actually lie outside making contemporary literature, contemporary poetry even, which we perhaps could speak about later, vibrant to a broader audience. The Department of English, I think, is trying hard to make the value of this kind of writing accessible to a broader audience. We've organized a number of events and evenings around the work of writers from Britain and the States who we have been lucky enough to host over the past years. And those events always appear to resonate. But I think the difficulty really is convincing people in the clash of contemporary media that given a choice between reading a novel or perhaps watching a film or playing a digital game, why go to the novel rather than anything else? And I do think that the encounter with literary fiction should necessarily be forced upon anybody. I think, without wanting to be too mystical, there's probably a call that one is aware of, and you're just irresistibly drawn, I think, to writing.
Let's pass on to a contemporary writer, Julian Barnes. And in his latest book, I think it is, Nothing to be Frightened Of, he speaks about books that he would have given an arm and a leg to have written. Here he's referring to these books which he's indebted to,
yes,
really, isn't he?
Yes, yes. I think that's a wonderful phrase in what is really an extraordinary book. I think it's a book I have a great admiration for. I think he's probably never written a book that is so consistently impressive throughout. There's the poise and the control of tone in this book is absolutely extraordinary. And at the center of the book is, of course, a very, very, very unnerving theme. It's the theme of death. Barnes does suggest in the book that ultimately this is the subject of all literature. The book is not a novel. It could perhaps be more accurately described as a memoir. And a memoir is, this very strange genre which incorporates elements of the essay and of autobiography, of reminiscence, and of an overarching, perhaps, tendency towards fictionalization and all that. And what the book is about is Barnes's recollection of deaths in his family. So there's a cheerful topic to be discussing in a radio interview, but it's, as you would expect from Barnes, it's done humorously, but also with, I think, an intense ability to communicate wistfulness and regret. And
I must say, I found it I found it quite bleak, really.
Yes, there are aspects of it which are quite bleak. And the fact that there is humor in the book doesn't really quite take the edge off the seriousness of what is being discussed. There's an interesting structure to the book as well, in that Barnes keeps referring to writers who have spoken about death. And what's interesting about all this is that it seems to be an emerging trend in contemporary letters. Edward Said, the great critic, wrote an absolutely wonderful book called On Late Style, in which he reflects on why writers might, or critics might, wish to write as they do towards the later stages of their life. In other words, you know, why... what changes in a writer's work, what changes in a writer's style, what changes even in a writer's themes as they grow older and, of course, more mature and possibly in greater control of their considerable literary powers. And Barnes speaks in the book of you know, these books he admires and the books he would have given an arm and a leg to have written. And it's all wonderfully modest, of course, because the book is technically so accomplished that I'm sure many writers look upon it with envy. In fact, in conversation with other writers, what comes through, I think, you know, they have very, very cheerfully acknowledged that this is a book they envy and would dearly have loved to have been able to lay claim to.
I remember reading the first book I read of his, and I remember at the end closing it and thinking, wow, you know, I really wish I could have written that myself. Obviously not being a writer or anything like that, but I just felt that sort of admiration for it.
You can only sit back and admire. It's a very different book, of course, to his early works like Flaubert's Spirit, The Wonderful Flaubert's Spirit, or The Delightful A History of the World in 10½ Chapters. This is a different book entirely.
You mentioned Edward Said there and his analysis of writers, of literature. Literary criticism is obviously very much part of your studies and your work. How would you define it, really, criticism as such?
Well, literary criticism has many strands to it, doesn't it? At its most accessible, it involves everything that perhaps could be categorized as literary appreciation. Anything that helps readers to appreciate good writing could be part of that. I would say that literary criticism at its most accessible is probably something we encounter in a review in the newspapers, perhaps. You know, these guides we get to deciding where is my next good read coming from, as it were. But of course, the big topic of contentiousness here, the big controversial issue, is the increasing detachment, unfortunately, that many readers feel in regard to what is happening to the practice of literary criticism within the university, within the academy. I think there has always been an expectation among the public that literary criticism should, at its best, educate taste, so to speak. Tell us who the great writers are and why they are great and why we should read them and why we should care. And why, if we care about great writing, somehow the very fabric of our culture and our civilization is in some mysterious way better. And I think that never goes away. What has happened, I would say, since the war is that the study of literary criticism, the study of literature, indeed, has become increasingly professionalized. So as the study of literature has become a university subject, the discourse through which that study mediates itself has become increasingly complex, increasingly part of language, if you like, an idiom, a critical idiom, spoken by academics, students studying literature, in a manner that perhaps institutes a little gap between how literature is studied within the university and how literature is encountered beyond the university. I think the trends in this are changing. I think we're over the phase in which literary theory, as it has come to be called, was perhaps a little bit too turgid, a little bit too hermetic. I think the pendulum is swinging back towards possibly greater accessibility.
Mm. But literary theory in the academic milieu, especially in these last years, has been looked upon by the professionals in a sort of dynamic way. There's been quite a few strands going on, quite a few things.
Yes,
perhaps
yes,
the public is not so keen on knowing about the dynamics of it, but they want something solid in their hands to read, whereas the academics are doing other things.
Yes, yes, yes.
Maybe a university milieu is also for that, though.
Yes, I think there's a very intense value in coming up with a critical discourse which is specialized, as it were, in the study of literature, and which allows the specificity of literature as a discourse to shine through. Why is literature different? Why are literary texts different from other texts? This is ultimately the question that all criticism ultimately hinges on. Can we recognize literariness? I think there is always an interesting discussion that we tend to have with students, where we ask them to put themselves in a situation where they're faced with perhaps 20 or 30 manuscripts. Perhaps they might be, this is speculation, of course, hypothetically speaking, they might be working in a publisher's offices and 30 manuscripts come in and they've got to make a decision about the one that is really literary, the one that is really valuable. Can we recognize that? Would we be able to recognize the great writer when we are not told that his or her writing is great? That is, I think, a very significant challenge. And of course, we would all hope that we would be able to recognize great writing. And hopefully what literary theory does is sensitize us to that a little more.
Well, Professor Kallous, there were plenty of other questions I would have loved to have asked you. Thank you very, very much for being with us today. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks.
My guest today was Ivan Kallous. I do hope that you can join me again next week for another edition of Talking Books. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.